Welcome to Back from the Abyss. I'm Dr. Craig Heacock. During my third year of psychiatry residency at the Rhode Island Hospital Intensive Outpatient Program, I unexpectedly fell in love. Now, not with a person or with the hospital's clam chowder, because in those days, Butler Hospital had the best clam chowder, hands down. I fell in love with a process. For this was my first time being introduced to process-oriented group therapy. And I was blown away by its beauty and mystery and riskiness and inherent wisdom. Learning to be a group process therapist was completely fascinating and so different than doing one-on-one therapy. Process groups are a very specific type of group, not a support group, not an educational group, but rather a container for group members to work out their transferences and projections in a supercharged way. Group process therapy can be like individual therapy on steroids, and I found that totally compelling. I ended up doing an extra year of group therapy training during my fourth year, and I fully expected to make group work a significant part of my psychiatric practice. But alas, the realities of working post-residency in a big hospital system set in. And I never did get to play out my dreams of being like Irvi Alam, leading therapy groups with thoughtfulness and discernment and the occasional provocation. Yet group therapy has not gone away by any means. And in certain realms, group work is integral, such as in addiction recovery or in the emerging psychedelic space. Besides the supercharging of transference and projection, groups have economic advantages and could potentially allow more people access to care. Today, I sit down with Carrie Haynes, a colleague and Colorado-based group therapist and host of the podcast, The Art of Groups. We explore our shared love of group process, the unique benefits and risks of working with groups, specific challenges for the group therapist or leader, and finally, how and why Carrie is moving away from traditional group therapy to a more heart-focused transpersonal group model.
Okay, well, I think we have to go all the way back, like we always do. I grew up in Ohio, in a really small town, and I am number two of five. Growing up, I think, well, the sense of my family, so my parents were very young when they had kids, like 18, 19. And my dad had untreated bipolar disorder. Now we know this. At the time, we didn't. And so there was a lot of fluctuation in the household, my dad's mood and my mom responding to that. And so when I really think about when I became a group therapist, it was then. Because the way that I coped with this family, I had four siblings, very, very close in age. I'm number two, really sensitive, picking up on the environment. And the way I protected myself and sort of made sense of my world was tuning in to the dynamic. And I think I was the harmonizer. And I also think that the way that I got connected to my parents was by tuning into them and providing to them in little ways what I could sense that was needed to help the dynamic in the house. So I think most of us become therapists in our family of origin. And one of the ways that it worked for me was to develop those skills. So then fast forward many, many years later, I was in graduate school at Colorado State University, and I actually was seeing a therapist in the counseling center. You know, they always say, do your own work. And I was doing that, and she recommended that I try interpersonal process group therapy. And I did. And honestly, I will say that I hated it. Like, I was like, what is this? The therapists are doing nothing. They are just sitting there. But the funny part is my stuff totally came out the way it does in process groups because I wanted to learn how to do it right. I was like, how do I do this well and right? And that was, you know, that was some of my conditioning, is to keep myself safe by learning what the environment wanted and needed from me and then performing. And so I saw that dynamic in, because they weren't going to tell me in my process group how to do it right. I had to figure out how to be myself. So
do you think she saw something in you, that individual therapist, that thought this young woman would benefit in particular from group therapy, or was she just a fan of the model? And
that was probably both. Mm-hmm. Both. And I think that that's an important piece too, because, you know, I was traditionally aged for grad school. And I feel like the central themes at that time in life are, who am I and who am I in relation to others? And how are the ways that I responded in my family of origin serving me or not serving me now that I'm in new contexts and new relationships? And that was all the themes that I was working on in therapy. So I think she saw the ways that group therapy could serve the central tasks of the work I was doing with her. And also, I'm so relational that I bet she also probably just knew that I would fall in love with it. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you remember, it's funny to hear your impression that the therapists weren't doing anything, but do you remember in those early weeks and months of you being in group therapy, like what kinds of, I don't know, what kinds of insights or experiences or things that sort of moved you forward and made you a believer that the, you know, psychodynamic process groups actually, you know, can be important change agents?
Yeah. I think, you know, based on my family of origin, my mom was a really loving, wonderful person. And my dad too, you know, he just couldn't be as consistently loving with us. He had a lot of rage and so there was inconsistency. But I also think my mom was really overwhelmed. She had a lot going on. I think she was managing my dad, and she also had 5 children who were young. What happened in group therapy that really made me a believer is that I think I yearned for the presence and connection and deep attunement that is available, and I saw it and felt it in those rooms. And it was especially poignant because there was not content to distract us. I think a lot of times in groups, other types of groups, we have therapists who want to get so much in, so much material, that they miss the deep yearning. And for me, that was the deep yearning, is I just wanted to feel that sense of connection and slowing down and being really seen, and I could get it there. Mm-hmm. And the therapist doing nothing actually allowed me, because they were doing something. They were facilitating that rather than their own agenda of teaching us something.
People who don't understand process psychodynamic groups, if you were to watch one, they would be kind of Seinfeldian in that they're kind of about nothing. You know, like there's it's not about like how to stay sober or ways to not be depressed or ways to help parent your child. The groups are about what's happening in the moment between people, the spoken and unspoken things that are just happening in the space.
Yes. There's this whole subterranean level that we don't talk about, but that we're all aware of, and this thing that's happening between and among us that I think it's really engaging and provocative when we get to talk about it. And I think that also drew me, that I could say the things. I think I was intuitive and in tune, and a lot of times it felt freeing to be able to say, I'm wondering what you're thinking of me right now, mm-hmm. instead of just silently wondering that. And then when I would get a response and be able to match that up with my internal experience and start to see like where I was coming, you know, what lens I was coming through and how they were viewing me, like it was so fascinating. It was like my inner world could be projected out onto a screen in this room. And so I could see it more clearly, and others could too. Mm-hmm. And that the opportunities for that was every person in the room, right? Mm-hmm.
It's almost like out of the nothingness of a process group can come incredible emotion and fire and I had told you about this, Carrie, but I was in a in residency. I did a group process therapy retreat in Boston, and I was in a group with maybe 9 people, me, my co-chief resident, and 7 other people. And it seemed like the first 2 hours not much happened. And I remember thinking, are these leaders going to do anything? What is this group? It's like, this is a group about nothing. And then I don't know that I said much in the first 2 hours, but at about hour two, a woman in the group looked at me and she said, "You are an arrogant asshole." I was really hurt. I said, "Really? Like, I haven't even really said anything." And, you know, that catalyzed this whole exploration of her and what she brought to the group and what was being put on me and how she perceived me and how other people perceived me. And, you know, that was like 2 hours of material, maybe 3 hours, her one comment looking at me and calling me an arrogant asshole.
Yes. Yes.
And it was thrilling.
Yes.
I remember thinking that group went from just like 2 hours of space and waiting and wondering to just on fire. And then I had led process groups as part of my training in residency, but I hadn't experienced that being in one, just feeling like the whole fire, the whole group and the space between us was just crackling. And
whew. Yeah. Yeah. There's like this, you can feel the energy shift when we get to that and we're actually relating in the here and now. I notice like all the members like perk up and time goes by so fast because we're in the moment. So I'm curious, I want to ask you, how did they did the facilitators handle that skillfully? Because that's where it can also go wrong, right? So did you feel like you got something like growth and from that interaction?
My memory is that they did nothing until about hour five. I think it helped that it was a group of therapists. Mm-hmm. Everybody was at least a master's level therapist, and then a couple of us were psych residents. So I remember people coming in to sort of, you know, to process and to sort of, it's almost like some of the group, people in the group stepped up to be the co-therapist, which is maybe what the therapists were hoping, is that, and I do remember thinking, wow, this is getting really intense and the co-leaders are doing nothing. But, you know, it'd be really interesting to go back and look at a video of that. Maybe they were doing exactly what they needed to. And, you know, I think so often, you know, as individual therapist, it's if we don't know what to do, we should probably do or say nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think as a group therapist, that might be even more magnified.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're always looking for the group therapist to jump in. And what is it like? I mean, that's another big component of process-oriented groups is the therapist not saving and intervening and directing, but so we can let the natural way emerge, because what they were observing and what you were observing is how do you handle it when somebody says that to you? What's your experience? And then how does Joe over here who's watching it? So there is this really unstructured, but that's what allows all of that naturalness for her to even say that to you. That projection to come out.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that's just so amazing about group therapy is that, you know, in one-on-one therapy, there's sort of one opportunity for transference, counter-transference, or for projection or projective identification. But in a group, there's all these places where your stuff can get triggered. Mm-hmm. And it's just this rich ground of potential transferences and places to project and places to misinterpret and places to just put your baggage on people. I remember another group experience I had that, you know, all weekend retreat where there was a guy in the group who the first day and a half, I just loathed him. And I just thought, I can't stand you. After like a day and a half, I realized, oh, he's a lot like me. Mm. And then he became my good bud. Mm-hmm. But again, unless you sit in a group like this and just have deeply open, brutal feedback from different people, and then the interpretation of the feedback, and then your response to that. And it's like the world's most intense 360-degree eval.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, right? Because I think for a lot of people, they're like, wow, that sounds horrible and terrifying, right? Like someone hating me. But actually, if you think about it, like the most rewarding, intimate relationships of our lives have all of that, you know, like your partner, like the times that you can hate them or dislike them or, but it's like, that's what intimacy is being able to work through that. And also the deep love you have when you work through conflict and when you really, you know, someone can nail it for you and see the parts of you that you think you're hiding, and they still love you anyway, you know, like, and that happens in these groups. Mm-hmm. Like, there's really that deep love that comes through along with the really challenging feedback.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned the word love. I would say by the end of that second weekend retreat, I really loved that guy. Mm-hmm. And there was a end of the retreat party, and he and I hung out. We were inseparable. And I remember we gave each other the biggest hug. And I said, I'm going to miss you so much. And I don't know what happened to him, but yeah, I really grew to love him over that weekend. Mm-hmm. And that could not have happened without that crucible of the group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I remember having a male facilitator in a group that I was in who was a, you know, the leader. And of course, like some of the stuff I've shared about my relationship with my father, of course, that stuff came up. But this facilitator was one of the most warm, consistent, gentle souls. And I would still experience him at times as unpredictable or angry. And then he would meet me consistently with this like warm, empathic, patient presence. And that was so healing to be able to, it felt like it rewired something in me with men in authority to be in that group and to be met in a way that was really different than what I had expected and what I had projected onto him. So those are the healing moments. There are some challenging moments too that I can share where I feel like I've been in a process group that went wrong. But those are the healing moments I think of.
What does that look like when it goes wrong?
Well, I have an experience because I think there's a lot of ways it can go wrong, honestly, right? Talk about a messy thing. 8 human being psychologies in a room, 2 facilitators who, you know, could be at their worst or their best. And then we're all mixing it up and just kind of, it's kind of like, and no structure. So here we go, right? But one experience I was at a group therapy conference. So this was like a lot of other group experts or professionals. And it was actually my partner and I, Jeremy, and he's a psychologist before we were married. And we're at this conference, and the last day, you know, the last day of the conference when everybody's like catching the plane, it was like a day-long intensive. And it was on aggression and conflict in the group therapy room. So it was a really like provocative session, and it was all day. But what was happening was people kept leaving the session because they had registered and then they'd go catch their flights to leave. So we went to lunch, and when we came back, the group had gotten significantly smaller. There were maybe like 9 of us left. And without any forewarning, the facilitator, the person who was presenting, turned it into a process group, but didn't ask any of us, like, hey, this is now going to be our own process group. He just started facilitating it like a process group. And, you know, people are game for it, kind of. But at one point, he looks to Jeremy and I and he says, so you two are here together? And we're like, yeah, we came to the conference together. He's like, why didn't you tell the group? We're like, what? He's like, you know, you always need to let the group know, because a couple relationship will always go above the group and it creates. So basically, he was trying to drum up conflict, I think, for his own, you know, to show off kind of like the facilitation skills. And he needed something to work with. That's my sense. I mean, I don't know. That's my guess. And we ended up being the ones. So then he was kind of like, tell them what you think, you know, other people in this workshop, tell them what you think. And we were just like completely confused. People were analyzing our relationship, and we were like, we showed up for a workshop at a conference.
Not so much consent.
No consent. Mm-hmm. And it felt very clear that we were just kind of being used to demonstrate a point. And it happened. I mean, there was definitely conflict, but I left that feeling really bad and heightened. And Jeremy and I had a lot of work to do because at a certain point when we were both getting a lot of feedback, he kind of like dropped back and I started leaning forward and I was like, why didn't you say something? You know, so it set up some conflict with us. So I think when a facilitator's ego or priorities kind of get amiss, they don't realize the impact they could have on the participants.
Mm-hmm. And also because unlike individual therapy where the individual therapist is, you know, speaking with some regularity, it's common in a process group and a psychodynamic group that the leader, co-leaders might not speak for long periods of time, mm-hmm. which almost gives them way more power when they do. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe what one of the things that this guy was quote unquote demonstrating was the power of the group therapist.
Yes.
To like, oh yeah, we're all in this group. We're all together. We're all on the same level. No, that's actually not true. The mm-hmm. group leader has the power to actually throw bombs, to throw like cluster bombs that are exploding over certain members of the group or the whole group. I'm wondering, you and I talked about that a little bit before we started recording, but that sounds like that became a way that you became maybe less enchanted with process therapy and starting to see that actually it can do real good or it can do harm.
Mm-hmm. So I fell in love with the intimacy and the vulnerability that I saw and the deep attunement and connection that was possible in those spaces. And even more so than in individual therapy, because there's still like, I always say like, I am your ideal relationship as an individual therapist. I hang on your every word. I'm available when you need me. I have no needs. You know, you only have to be with me for the hour and you get to leave. You know, like this is not a real relationship. Whereas in group, like, there are other human beings with their needs. So I felt like it felt more like real life. But there was something that would happen when things would go south, like that example I have. And I saw it in lots of ways where sometimes I wondered, like, was harm happening or were people actually reinforcing the patterns rather than it being a corrective experience? It would reinforce some of their early dynamics or negative beliefs about themselves, or someone would get scapegoated. And groups are powerful. I say powerful for good or powerful in ways that can be very harmful because everything's amplified. I never really knew what was the secret sauce. I had a sense, but when the magic would happen and I would be like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is the work. And then other times I'd be like, ooh, this felt icky, or it felt like more conflict, or I don't know if I'd want to be a member in this group that I'm facilitating. And that was confusing for me. And the power we had, like I was aware of the power that I had, but I think I'm even more aware now, right? Because I'm a new therapist learning how to do this while I'm in my own development. So yeah, I got disillusioned with therapy, with process-oriented groups, but it was slowly over time that I was like, is there something more? And I think that I want to say that this tracked with my own journey. So I'm healing. I'm in my own journey of figuring out who I am in the world. And I started noticing that I was, you know, at first I was trying to feel like, who am I in relationship with others? How do I get a sense of belonging? How do I heal some of these patterns? But then my work seemed to evolve into where I was more interested in like the divine and my spirituality, my spiritual nature. I grew up Catholic and I didn't really connect to Catholicism. And so there was this part of me that moved away from seeking healing in relationship with others. And I was looking more out to the divine and even my relationship with myself. And so I think at that same time, as I was starting to look, I noticed that I was working with people who had more of a spiritual perspective that were outside of Western psychotherapy, and I was getting more healing in those spaces than in a traditional counseling space. And that was also coinciding with me becoming a little disillusioned with my work in process-oriented groups. So it was a parallel process.
Mm-hmm. Right, because there is something about process groups as a group, but it's not... it's not the community in a way like of a community. It's an individual. Well, how does it's like it's a number of, you know, 8 or 10 individuals who are interacting as a bunch of individuals, but it doesn't have that like hive mind, you know, animistic communitarian thing. It's 8 or 10 individuals all sitting facing each other.
Yeah.
And so it does kind of still build off that, you know, kind of the Western psychologized mindset of, you know, we are each our own psyche. We need to work individually, maybe in a group, but that's how we heal individually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And there was a sense to that. Well, what I know now when I look back is that there was a sense that there's a pattern or there's something that you might be doing that's getting in your way. And if we could just find it and work on it, then you're going to be okay. Then you're going to feel good. And I'm not saying every group therapist comes from that lens, but there definitely was, you know, psychodynamic group therapists, but there was a sort of for the good of the client, but, you know, finding those places that were in their way of feeling their love and belonging and all of that. And so I've sometimes felt like a detective as a group therapist, like, let's find it to help them heal it. Mm-hmm. And now what I know is that the groups that were magic, it was because we were in our heart. It really was that simple, that there's something that I see happen in group settings that when people can drop out of their head and into their heart, that reliably I can create the magic if I can get people to do that. I don't have to do anything else, but my job is to help them move from head to heart. And the rest just happens. And what I didn't know when I was doing these process-oriented groups is that that's what I needed to do. So sometimes it would just happen because maybe I was more heart-centered or a member came in and showed vulnerability and we all dropped in. Things would happen and then we would have the magic. But if we didn't, if I came in maybe more heady or in my ego or trying to figure something out, we might just have a bunch of egos bumping up against each other in a room and the magic wasn't as palpable, wasn't there.
You see vulnerability as sort of the step, maybe the initial step or a crucial step from head to heart?
Mm-hmm. I see vulnerability, and I also see, and we're kind of jumping, when I moved, I learned about circle work. There are some practices that I use now that help people make that shift, and they involve things like singing. They involve things like listening to a beautiful piece of music. They involve being
as,
in nature.
As a circle.
As a circle. Like I bring those in now. I'll read poetry in my groups just to help us shift out of that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes meditation can help people move into their heart. If we come into a room and we just start talking, it's less likely that we're going to drop. And so actually doing more movement, these other practices seem to be, and medicine, seem to be a way that we have more access to the heart. And then, you know, we do need to talk. We have that. But I find that it's so much more powerful when we do these other ways, these other strategies to help people to move. When we slow down and we have some spaciousness, just the heart is so much more available. And when the heart's available, the type of interaction that's really healing is more possible.
Yeah. I wonder if we might delve further into your transition from doing mostly process groups to circles. And it's sounding like maybe one key difference is that process groups are really in the head and that circle work is heart-centered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to tell you about a dream I had because I think it's very poignant and it's about this transition. So After when I was leading process-oriented groups and I was feeling this disenchantment, I had this dream, and here I am, and I am, and this is kind of provocative, I'm in bed with a person. He was a good friend, and I saw him as a very evidence-based psychologist, and we were good friends. And we're in bed together, and he has his arm around me, and I am so pregnant, but I'm aware that he doesn't know. And I'm thinking, he doesn't know, and I don't want him to know that I'm this pregnant in this dream. And there, I get this awareness that this baby's coming. Like, there's no way to hide this. I'm like 9 months pregnant, you know? And at that moment, I could feel his arm around me. And it was both comforting and so heavy. Like, it felt like it was pinning me down. And when I zoom out, what that dream was for me was, I feel like in the dream, he really represented this patriarchal way that I had grown up learning how to do my healing work. And it was very comfortable and safe, but there was something more coming forth. There was like a way that I intuitively, or maybe in my lineage or something, knew healing could happen that was juicier and like a little more out of the box, a little fuller. And I was, you know, terrified to be more woo-woo, I guess I would say, you know, to go into like, oh, now we're going to sing in our groups. You know, I thought like, what is my university background going to think of this, right? Or, and so that was like a pivotal time. And I went through a lot of iterations of trying to figure out like, how do I bring these things together? This part of me that's more spiritual and intuitive and wants to bring in energy and all these other ways of healing, and also I think part stay safe and stay in this academic model that I know evidence-based works, and I have the theory, right? But you know, again, the dream showed I was like, I was already so far gone, I was moving in that direction and knowing that there was something more. So it wasn't that process-oriented groups, I still feel like those skills and what I learned there I will always use. Super powerful, because even in my circles, it's still personalities. There's still process, there's conflict, and all of that stuff was so juicy. I just now see it as one piece in a much larger frame. Whereas when I was doing it before, and that was my primary modality, it was the whole frame. And now the frame is much larger, and this process-oriented, I see as like relational education. It's an important and vital part, and there are other parts.
So how did you transition from being primarily process group therapist to now doing more circle work? And what did that look like for you, sort of, I don't know, not just training-wise, but experientially and maybe spiritually, and how that process may have changed you?
Mm-hmm. It was slowly. Like, I started to, so Tara Brach is one of my heroes. I love her, and she's been a teacher for me. She's a mindfulness meditation teacher and a psychologist. And I started just incorporating mindfulness at the beginning of my process groups. And I noticed that when I would do a meditation or mindfulness, which is not the same as process groups, they say don't, you know, it's just a blank slate. But the quality of sharing and interaction would be deeper, because I think I didn't realize them, but I was dropping people into their hearts. I was helping them, especially in our world that's so head-centered. So that was one way. And then the big shift happened when I was doing all this research, because I was feeling this concern about what else is out there. And I was looking around, and I found this woman, and her name is Jalaja Bonheim. And she actually coined the term like circle work as a whole word. So some people say circle work, but she has a modality called circle work that she created. and she's based out of Ithaca, New York. And I think it was through Tara Brach, heard about Jalaja, and I applied and was accepted to be trained in circle work by her. And when I read about her modality, you know, something in me just lit up and I knew this is for me. And so I flew to Ithaca, New York, and was trained in circle work. It's like a 5-day experiential training. And it has the aspects of relational education, but it also incorporates movement and ritual and music, time in nature. And also, she speaks explicitly about the need to move from head thinking into heart thinking. And I felt, for me, just being in that circle was really transformative as a participant. I felt like these patterns that I had worked on in other groups were just falling away. They were just, because there's an energetic sort of field that was created, and she will say kind of creating like a field of love, but it feels like this field of heart-centeredness, that anything that is not that sort of comes up to be healed or let go of. It felt like much less efforting, but I still felt the transformation happening in that.
What does it look like? Again, you know, I know what a process group looks like because I've been in those and led those. And for the listeners who don't know what that looks like, it looks like people saying, this is the way I experience you, or when you just said that, I thought this, or I'm not feeling close to you, or, you know, it's a lot, it's back and forth, you know, this is how I'm experiencing you, and this is what I'm thinking. But what about circle work? I mean, is it the same kinds of interactions happening, but with more sort of heart-driven, or does it actually look and unfold in a different way?
Yeah, real different, I think. And I still think, I want to make sure that I make the distinction that there are absolutely some times that I feel like if someone came to me and they were like, I'm really struggling with these patterns and relationships, I may think a process-oriented group is a better fit because they're, you know, looking at how do I heal a pattern that I have in relationships. That can also be addressed in circle work. But coming into a circle, what you're going to see is a lot less of that interaction. This is what I think of you. This is what I'm feeling towards you. Although that does come up, more often than not, it's more focused on my relationship with the divine, whatever that means to me, and my relationship as what I would say, like a planetary citizen, is more like who am I in relation to other beings and the planet? So it's this much bigger frame. And so it's less focused on interpersonally what's happening between you and I.
It's much bigger.
Much bigger. Yeah. Yeah. And yet there are still people and personalities in a room and conflict happens. But the only reason you're addressing those patterns and that is if it's getting in the way of the other pieces of work that are happening. So whereas a process group is really focused on exploring those dynamics, interactions, a circle work is not. Mm-hmm. Circle work is more focused on how do you connect deeply to your own wholeness and remember your wholeness and remember that you are part of something much greater. And I think circle work focuses on the collective. So sometimes, like you talked about, like in process groups, we're looking at my pain and my story and how do I interact with you? Whereas I feel like circle work is more like the pain. We're looking at the pain of and how we each have a thread of more of a global collective.
Yeah. Which I think it's such a beautiful explanation and maybe understanding of why psychedelics are being used in circle work. Because, you know, I'm imagining a process group on mushrooms. There would be not much process. Yeah, but because many of the psychedelics can potentially connect us to something much bigger and vaster than ourselves, to the oneness or the anima or the, you know, greater spirit, that you could imagine where circle work might become potentiated by adding various medicines to it. I wonder if you might say more about how you think about circle work with and without psychedelics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that circle work, I've had the experience that it's as powerful to me as some of my powerful medicine experiences on its own, because it does feel like we move into a different state of consciousness. It's funny, this is all coming to me as we're talking about like dreams. The dreams are big for some reason today. But another dream I had before I had found circle work was just imagining my work in the world. And it was a group of women laying on the floor, and all of their bodies stayed laying down and their souls sat up and held hands. And that really is what circle work feels like to me, is that we actually kind of de-emphasize the personality and the ego to get to some deeper core essence, that some of the practices help to bring that up. And so I also feel like that's what medicine does, in a way that when I've experienced medicine, even in community, that a lot of those ways that we've protected ourselves, those barriers that we put up to protect our hearts, just naturally fall or relax, and we are more available for a connection. We're more in our hearts, and you know, we're connected to something bigger than ourselves. And so circle work, we can do that through all of these practices, but what I've seen is medicine will do that. And then the integration and the processing that can happen and the connection that can happen after and between and among people, the medicine helps to facilitate that too. So the other piece is that circle work really does awaken that sense of oneness. So one of the things that Jalaja, my teacher, does is she does peace circles in the Middle East between Palestinian and Israeli women to bring them together. And to, so we can't just come together. I mean, you know how long that conflict has been going, just to talk about it, right? Like, we're not getting anywhere with that. So she uses the practices of circle work to awaken that, like, yes, we're on different sides of this thing, but I am you and you are me, you know, and you're worried about your children and I'm worried about mine, you know? And I feel like we need practices like this, medicine, and to know that like we are part of a bigger community. There is a oneness, and we're at a point in history, in evolution, where we need to learn that fast. And so I see psychedelics helping us with that. And I also see circle work as looking at a more of a global perspective. And I think as we move through our healing journeys, that naturally happens. First, we're healing ourselves, and then we get to a certain point where we start to say, like, now that I'm at a place of healing, how do I use my life to help others and to help the planet and to move this thing forward?
Mm-hmm. I hear you when you say that group work without medicines can be just as, you know, profound or spiritual or as ecstatic. But I think we could probably both agree that in general, the heat gets turned up more with these. And I'm wondering how you think about some of the challenges for group leaders in the circle space who are using medicines to facilitate connection to something bigger, for the group to cohere and be part of something bigger. But how can that go well, and how can that maybe not go so well?
Mm-hmm. I think there's increased vulnerability with medicine, and we're more open. And I think in a lot of ways that can catalyze change and connection and belonging. One of my favorite teachers, he says, Gibran Rivera, he says, right now we have a crisis of connection and meaning. And I think psychedelics give us a lot, an antidote to that, and group work can just amplify that connection and meaning together. And at the same time, I think we are so open on medicines that the vulnerability, the potential for harm. And now we're not just worried about, is the facilitator going to cause harm? But now we have other members, other people in the room with their own pain, with their own suffering that can also cause harm. So I think we have to be really alerted to the boundaries that need to be present in a group space so that the vulnerability required to really be in the medicine is honored, and that we're holding that tight. So some of the things that I think are important just on a really practical level is I'm seeing some people doing medicine work in groups that are just much too large of groups for there to be good holding.
Yeah. What do you consider kind of an ideal size for a medicine group?
I think it depends on the medicine. And I also think it depends on the participants. Like one thing I think we talked about is, you know, who isn't right? And I think, let's say we have somebody with like a lot of trauma that's doing individual work. I think they could work in a group if the group was very small. Let's say 3 people, right? There's a group, but there's so much space for them to do also their individual work, especially if they're processing a big trauma. Whereas somebody who's done a lot of their work and they just want to more have a collective experience, I think we could get up to 8 people with 2 facilitators and probably be okay. So it depends on who and what the goals are of that particular gathering. I really like right now, I do ketamine-assisted psychotherapy circles, and I limit it to 4 and myself. And everyone that I accept in, I've done some individual work with. So I know how they react to the medicine. I know their history. I'm aware if there's anything like lurking that they kind of don't want to come up, like making sure that they've faced some of those things before we're in the group. I love that size. And I work a lot on building community between and among them for integration and support in between. So I know that that's not the most satisfying answer, but
I think variable, but I also hear you when you say too big, because I've heard, you probably heard these stories too. I've heard a number of stories of psychedelic circles that were large, like 18, 25, 35, and things went way south.
Yeah.
Like the group leaders were completely either unable or unwilling to maintain safety, to figure out ways to help people who are really struggling. There was just so many people in the room. It just, you know, it was, you know, beyond a kerfuffle. It was a full-on shit show.
Yes. So, yes. That concerns me, you know, and I even think energetically, like how far we have that awareness of how much we're going to be willing to go. And if you have that much energy, that many bodies, that many experiences in the room, I would hold myself back because I would sense on some level that there isn't the holding or safety for me, as opposed to a smaller, more intimate setting where there's more trust built. Because also these 18, 20 person groups, sometimes it's the first time everyone's met each other. Like there's no container built at all. And for me, that's just not how I work.
It seems like the key task of a group therapist and an individual therapist, but really of a group therapist, is to maintain safety. And, you know, in a process group, you're trying to prevent people from reenacting or acting out stuff in too brutal a way, or people getting re-traumatized or victimized, or kind of the group thing where everybody gangs up on somebody, or, you know, you're trying to be sort of the referee. You want there to be heat, but you don't want people to get seriously injured. You know, you really are like a referee. And then in the circle space, it seems like you also are trying to maintain safety, but then when you add medicine, psychedelic medicine, as you said, the kind of vulnerability that can come out. And then the other thing I wonder is, I would guess that a lot of people who are going to be doing psychedelic circles aren't necessarily well-trained group therapists. And so they aren't confident or trained about knowing how and when to intervene. And their default would be to be passive.
Yeah.
But as you and I both know, you know, the best individual therapists and the best group therapists sometimes are extremely proactive and even aggressive in their interventions, because when they see things are heading south, they stop and they do something.
Yeah.
So I think my guess is there are going to be a lot of psychedelic circles in the future where the group leaders kind of see themselves as all on the same plane, like we're all in this together, we're all, you know, kind of kumbaya, om, you know, mm-hmm. And then when things start to head south, the group leaders don't really have the wherewithal to identify, to act, to reestablish safety in a way that can, you know, make it a good experience for everyone.
Yeah, I love that you're saying that, because that was some of my hesitation ever even identifying myself with circles, because I think that there is this sense of circles that, oh, anyone can do them, and you just have to know how to hold space. That's what people will say. And yeah, that's true on some level. And there is a skill where you have to hold space, and then you also need to know how to intervene and cut through and take action. And that is just as important as the presence and the attunement and the heart-centeredness, that there also is skill involved in creating safe, you know, brave spaces. And I do get concerned about that. I think, you know, you're less at risk for a very short-term few sessions that are highly structured. And maybe it's more with a medicine like ketamine, where, you know, it's more of an internal journey and we're just doing integration. You're probably less at risk for the shit show. But I think the longer any group meets any group, it will always become a process-oriented group with difficult dynamics, like always. And so just being aware of that is helpful and important, and that's not a bad thing, that's just like human nature, and that the skills to work with that. I remember being at one of my psychedelic, you know, trainings, and even during our process-oriented, you know, our time where we were processing and integrating, there were so many process dynamics, and the facilitators were having a hard time managing, you know, people who were sharing in ways that were unhelpful to the group. So I think that's when you're going to see some of this stuff, that a more process-oriented skill set could really serve. And then also on the other side, the circle to move out and give more space and ritual to work with the collective is also really helpful. That's a sign of a softer way of facilitating.
Mm, yeah. How do the skills needed and the sort of personal challenges for the group therapists, how are they different in the classic process group versus in a circle? Mm-hmm. And you could speak maybe to your own challenges, you know, having been trained and an expert in one form of group therapy, then moving into circle work. Like, what was that like for you? What did you have to sort of let go, give up? What did you have to develop or mm-hmm. change?
Yeah, in process-oriented groups, I found that I had to learn a lot about understanding the thing under the thing. And I loved that, you know, it's just so juicy, like what's going on that we're not talking about and not saying, but that is palpable in the room. What is happening at a collective level, not just an individual level, beyond the content, not just what is being said, but how and why at this moment, why are we talking about this? And the timing of intervention is pretty important. So as a group therapist, you really have to know where you are in the process when you start to facilitate things, because all groups go through the stages. What I felt like was difficult for me as a process, or some of the mistakes I made, was not really recognizing my privilege, like on my own identity development as a white woman, you know, cisgender, you know, when I think back, those are some of the regrets I have, that I didn't do more of my own work and acknowledging my own privilege, because I have a lot of privileged identities, and they definitely probably had an impact on my group members who might have more marginalized identities, and I wasn't aware. I didn't name those things. So I feel like, I mean, that's important for any therapist, for any group facilitator, but it's especially one of the ways that I feel like I don't even know if it's a mistake, but I just know that my lack of awareness and work and development are, I missed things or I didn't acknowledge things. So the more I know about myself, the more clear I am, I think the better process-oriented therapist I am. Mm-hmm. And now that I know that it takes being in the heart, I think the intention to be humble and in your heart as a facilitator, knowing how much power we have, I think process groups, I think I went through a time where I thought it was process groups that weren't really working. But now, in hindsight, I don't think it's the modality. I think it's the consciousness of the facilitator. I think process groups are beautiful, but I think you need to be really aware of your consciousness that you're bringing in as a facilitator in a process group, because that can really direct how that unfolds. Mm-hmm.
And maybe your conscious or often unconscious goals.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, because so much of what we do, maybe most of what we do as humans is unconscious, and definitely as group leaders or individual therapists, we think we're acting consciously, but we're almost never acting consciously. Mm-hmm.
And my biggest shadow in that too is like, I just want to be liked. That's like a terrible crux, because in a process group, it's important to be honest, and you may not be liked. And I had to work really hard on that because I wanted to be liked. It feels good to be liked. And that was a challenge because at times someone needed to be mad at me or not like me. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I learned a lot about being able to hold someone's anger or frustration and letting it not be totally about me.
Yeah.
And then the difference between the skills is I think now I am working much more as somebody who has to understand how to lead ritual, ceremony, singing. Like there are definitely different skills of comfort. I remember the first time I did like a static dance, I just cried. Like it was so uncomfortable for me to just be out there moving and healing. But, you know, it stretches me. I'm very comfortable in a Western psychotherapy model. And so getting out there and singing and dancing, like that was another form of vulnerability, not just spoken. But I found that the similarities are that the more I'm willing to be authentic in a process-oriented group and the same in a circle work, I'll say, this is hard for me, you know, and then it gives other people permission for it to be hard for them too. And I think now I'm not focused as much on all of the process between and among members. I'm more focused on facilitating people's connection to their heart and trusting that whatever comes up in the circle is what needs to happen and to be healed. But I'm much more hands off with that process. Mm-hmm. And not trying to seek out the dynamics. If the dynamics arise, I feel so grateful that I've been trained to deal with them. But it's just one piece.
Yeah. I so agree with Carrie when she talks about needing to know oneself deeply, to be mindful of the consciousness and biases and transferential lenses that we bring to therapy, especially in the group setting, where everything can heat up faster and things can go off the rails if the container and interpersonal safety aren't carefully maintained. Whether we are needing to be liked or even loved, or to be right or be believed, or simply just heard, group work offers the chance to have our interpersonal needs and deficits and shadow revealed, while also providing a real-time place to trust and grow.